All right. All right. What are we doing? Patreon.
Patreon. Wouldn't you all, Misfit Toys or whatever they you are, continue to do this work for no money whatsoever? I think the answer is maybe yes.
I would.
Yeah.
I think I have
just to get out of the
it.
House.
Yeah. Just
yeah.
For the love of God.
Yeah, no, it's important. And I think it matters that we're independent and we're not beholden to really anyone except you guys out there, the listeners, and that's why we need your help.
Connor,
simply said.
Connor, it should be said, launched a new wave of fundraising by protesting Ira Glass's claim that public radio was, quote, ready for capitalism. And he wrote a whole piece about why public radio was not now and never will be ready for capitalism.
Right. It's kind of
is that about right?
Contradiction in terms, right.
It's the first podcast ever. There's never been an ad on this sucker.
First podcast ever. That's right.
It speaks for itself, really.
And we do it with the help purely, 100%, of
that's right.
friends in the neighborhood. It's pretty amazing.
We can't produce this show if we don't have a budget.
Yeah.
And we have a very small budget.
Mm-hmm.
And this is how we do it.
All right. So what's the URL?
Patreon.com/radio open source. And there's a big orange button on the right. And you can become an underwriter. You could become a member of our steering committee. You could get invited to Chris Lydon's house for an evening around the piano or an afternoon around the piano. You could get a T-shirt. You could get
books.
You could get a terrific
books.
Book sent,
a lot
to,
of books.
Sent to you directly.
We have nothing but books.
From Brattle Bookstore, Boston's oldest bookshop, and home to a lot of cool books. And you could get, what else could you get? You could come and talk to us via Google Hangouts or show up impertinently, wait outside the front door on a Monday morning. I think we should allow that as a alternate.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anything goes at open source.
Yeah.
Now, on with the show, right?
On with the show.
Let's do it. And donate.
And donate. We need your help.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Forget Donald and Hillary and Bernie for this hour. What if the real question is, how's our democracy doing? The last best hope of Earth, Lincoln called it in 1862, on his way to the Emancipation Proclamation, a democracy founded on the dignity of all people as equals, a system, somebody else said, that can face and live with the truth about itself. What's the truth about ours? The line out there, and Andrew Sullivan is with us to speak it, is that our public process is collapsing in 2016 under a foul excess of democracy. Noisy, vulgar, all the wrong people showing up in a rage. But the suspicion recurs, and Jedediah Purdy will voice it, that more than half of the people are right more than half of the time, and it's up to us to listen. We begin with Jimmy Lee in South Bend, Indiana. He's one of those sharp voices in the fog that our friend Scott Carrier has a gift for recording. Jimmy Lee is a 34-year-old white man, a trumpeteer, he says, or a Trumpkin, who could vote for Bernie if only because the livelihoods he can find in Indiana today are beneath his dignity.
I'm Jimmy Lee out of Granger, Indiana. Well, you know, I grew up, you know, with a single mom. My dad was never really around with us, you know. My mom worked 3 jobs, went to nursing school, became an RN, and my mom, she's working so hard, and she can barely draw her benefits, but we have so many people here that are here illegally drawing our benefits, drawing government assistance, and we just need to put some control on, you know, put some control on some stuff, and really shake up the White House a little bit. Small business is not working. You know, I work for small companies, construction companies. I mean, I lift 140-pound panels, packing drywall all day, and I get paid, you know, $8.50 an hour. I can't get a job making more than $8 an hour. You know, and I got small businesses leaving. I've been laid off 3 or 4 jobs over the past 5 years because small businesses can't keep people like me working. You know, they're pulling out and going working for bigger companies, big corporations that are coming from out of state, you know, to work on a project that's local. It's just, we're getting pushed out. You know, and I have a house payment. I own a home. It gets harder and harder. I mean, there's not a lot of jobs anymore. In my order, it goes Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, stay at home. that's the way I stand about it. You know, it's just, I don't know a lot about politicians, but I'm a truthful person, you know. I'm just going to tell it like it is.
Save our nation. Save our nation.
Scott Carrier tells those marvelous stories on his podcast, Home of the Brave. He's based in Salt Lake City. Andrew Sullivan, proto-blogger, sometime war blogger, late of the Daily Dish and the New Republic back in the day. Welcome back to the fray from early retirement, Andrew.
Thank you.
Your comeback piece in New York Magazine provoked us to do this hour. You say Donald Trump is an extinction-level event for American democracy. And the panic headline points the blame squarely. It says, the case against the people. Our democracy has never been so ripe for tyranny, you're saying. What do you mean?
Where does it say the case against the people? I'm sorry, I didn't see that.
Well, that was on the front of the article with the melting marble of Abraham Lincoln in the background. Why blame the people for the Trump phenomenon?
Who do you blame for the Trump phenomenon, if not the people voting for him?
Well, it's never that simple. There are a lot of real circumstances, and Jimmy Lee, we just heard, is one of them. Make your own case about the danger of a slide toward tyranny, the extinction level event that you're worrying about. Those are your terms.
Well, I think that Donald Trump is an extinction level event for our liberal society and our democratic order. I think he's running for president on a platform in which he is promising to abuse the power he has. He's running for president on the basis of threatening violence to those who oppose him. He's running for president on the basis that there should be a religious litmus test for people to come into the country. And he's running for president on the basis of deporting and creating a police force sufficient to remove and deport 11 million men, women, and children. And that, and he, and at every point that we have knowledge of in his political campaign, when he's been confronted with any kind of institution to check him, he has regarded it as illegitimate. Therefore, I think that if this man were to win the presidency, and it's very possible, I think that the entire system could be under great strain, probably extremely dangerous strain. And I wrote this article in order to bring that to the surface. And so I don't really quite understand what on earth you're talking about.
I'm talking about the thrust of your article, which says there's too much democracy out there.
What it says is it repeats the classic concern with democracy, which is something that most people are familiar with, like the tyranny of the majority. And the American constitutional republic is designed to give a strong voice to that majority opinion. And over time, if that opinion, majority opinion, is sustained, it will have its way. But it also is designed to prevent, especially moments of extreme popular passion and feeling, from violating the system in which it's embedded. And that's why we have the separation of powers. That's why we have political parties. That's why we have a Supreme Court. That is why we have elites that in some ways do interact with that democratic force. And that's the vision that the founders created for this republic, in which democracy is an incredibly powerful force, but has to be and will be because of the knowledge of what democracy has done in history, what the passions of the mob can do to individuals, to private property, and to constitutions. It's important that it have elements within it, which the founders were very wise to put in it, to restrict pure majority rule, especially when it transgresses certain core boundaries, like an individual's private property or an individual's right to a fair trial and all the other rights guaranteed under the Constitution. And that can happen. And democracies have become tyrannies in the past. I needn't cite many, many examples, but especially when large majorities of people are seized with anxiety, are seized with legitimate fears, are seized with passion and anger, these things can be very dangerous, and our system is designed to constrain that. And what my concern in this particular instance is that since the Republican Party has also put the Supreme Court up for election, in this election we could have someone whose entire character and personality is tyrannical, together with two houses of Congress in his side and a neutered Supreme Court, who is telling us right now he intends to violate the Constitution upon getting into office, and intends to abuse his power upon getting into office, and is using some of the most disgusting neo-fascist arguments to get him into that position.
Andrew, that's
my concern. And he will. And that would be a triumph of a majority in this country. And that recognition, there should be some restraint on this, that we might have gotten to a point where in a reality TV culture and a totally democratized media, that such a demagogue could actually really begin to seize power in this country and destroy the system that we've been, you know, we've been lucky to inherit.
Andrew, I'd love you to...
I wanted to point out the danger of.
I hear your point.
And you're trying to make it seem as if I am hostile to the fears or anxieties of those people in this country who are going through terribly difficult economic times, when in fact the article shows considerable sympathy for those people. And instead is concerned about the political dangers, especially in times of anxiety, with popular passions that could overwhelm the system that we desperately need and that we are, should be proud to have.
We celebrate those restraints, those separations of powers, those bulwarks, and not particularly democratic in the Supreme Court and lots of other places. But you're alarmed, Andrew, that this game is much more vulnerable.
Aren't you alarmed by the possibility of Donald Trump becoming president? Aren't you alarmed?
I'm alarmed by so many things across the board here, and I don't...
Really? And this doesn't stick out among the many things to be alarmed about right now, that we have a neo-fascist running neck and neck for president of the United States?
Well,
this is not something that concerns you?
I want to go out and count all the symptoms and try to imagine all the causes of this thing. It's not simply that a very, shall we say, charismatic entertainer has taken over the public stage.
If he were to be elected president, which is a possibility, it would be because a majority of people in this country, barring some very close result in an electoral college kerfuffle, it would be because he won a majority of the vote, right?
Exactly, so, but I think that's our whole project tonight is to look at the democracy.
Electing a tyrant. That's my worry. You have a democracy that can elect, that can abolish itself.
Andrew, stand by, and we're going to hear from Jedediah Purdy immediately after the break. We're talking about democracy with Orlando Patterson, Gordon Wood at Brown, Francis Fukuyama from Stanford. We'll be back. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. With Andrew Sullivan and others' anxieties about our democracy, Gordon Wood is the historian's historian at Brown University, as close as anybody I know to the minds of Thomas Jefferson and the genius framers of the democracy we fret about. I asked him this week about our raging sea of populism in 2016.
I'm old enough to realize that these things come and go. I'm not in despair. I think we'll survive Donald Trump, even if he should become president. I think the republic will survive. There are a lot more institutions that protect us than the president. The president can do a lot, that's true, but we have a lot of other protections. We're not completely a democracy in that sense. We have a Supreme Court that is very undemocratic. We have a Federal Reserve Board, which is not at all democratic. And so we have institutions like that that were designed to be beyond the reach of the populace. Democracy has its dark side, as we know. I mean, if you go back, the framers are not really keen on democracy. If you read Madison's 10th Federalist, it's full of fears of democracy. Now, what they meant was direct democracy. It's hard to resist the appeal of democracy. But, you know, the Greeks that we like, Plato, Aristotle, Thucydides, they all disliked democracy. They needed to be balanced by aristocracy and monarchy. nobody preferred direct democracy or pure democracy. And that was true of the founders as well. It turned from a form of government, a technical political science form of government, into an article of faith. And we're playing with that article of faith now. It's almost impossible for anyone to oppose democracy. I mean, the parties shouldn't have to be democratic. But as soon as they act in any undemocratic way, someone appeals to this faith in democracy. This is the great danger, because it's hard to stand against it in our culture. The danger of democracy is majority tyranny. We are protected against that better than most governments. That's the great danger in Europe when a demagogue takes over. They don't have a Bill of Rights. They don't have minority rights protected in the way we do. That's why I'm not concerned, unless our whole court structure falls apart. I just don't see that happening.
That's Gordon Wood, historian of the radicalism of the American Revolution at Brown University. We're talking about the democracy, cued by Andrew Sullivan's long screed in the New York Magazine, with also Jedediah Purdy on the line and Orlando Patterson, the sociologist at Harvard, in our studio. Jedediah Purdy, plunge in here. You're a law professor at Duke, but I think of you more as a sort of Walt Whitman, Henry David Thoreau, wanderer, observer of our whole land. Plunge in on the democracy question. Are we endangered here by the Trump phenomenon?
Yes, we are. This is the most important question, the question that Andrew is posing, and I think this is why everybody is paying attention to what he's said and has said powerfully. I welcome Andrew to the list of people who are auditioning for Trump's enemies list, should he get in a position to execute on it, and share all of his anathema to Trump the man. So the question is a distinct one, right? It's not the character of Trump or the danger of the Trump campaign as such, though that's the question of first importance. There's also the question we have to think about, which is, what does Trump's success say about us, about our fellow citizens who are supporting him, and about this thing we like to call our democratic experiment? And that is the topic of Andrew's very provocative and important essay. And this is where we disagree. The argument that Andrew's given is part of a noble tradition of thinking that says that democracy is a state of culture and a state of the soul, which tends to self-indulgence, narcissism, lack of rational standards, ultimately piggishness and selfishness and violence, and that our culture is characterized by those forms of narcissism and self-indulgence, and also by a kind of, as he puts it, hyper-democracy in which people resist and overcome any structural barrier of the kind Gordon Wood was just talking about to the direct injection of their will into the political process. And then there is another pair of traditions, and those are the two that I stand with here. And the question of which of these we're going to think is more helpful in this terrible situation is very important. One part of these competing traditions lies with Whitman, as you said, and with Lincoln. It's the tradition that says democracy is a state of culture and of the soul in which we have to labor to avoid feeling disgust and contempt and horror at one another, even when we see our fellow citizens standing for something that is, in fact, horrible. Lincoln was the great practitioner of this idea, and its great exponent was Whitman. Trump has seized on a strand of contempt, disgust, and condescension, and he's made it the governing tone of his popular appeal and his claim to authority. And I think that in putting anathema on Trump, we all need to be very careful that we also maintain the Lincolnian virtue of listening to what our fellow citizens are saying when they make this, to me, disastrously, not to me, this disastrously ill-advised judgment. And this is where the second tradition comes in. The second tradition is the one that says democracy is, of course, about the equality, fundamentally about the equality and the dignity and the liberty of the individual and majority rule. But it is also about the idea that was Lincoln's, that he called free labor, the idea of the dignity of working people, of ordinary people, and the idea that that dignity should be recognized and rewarded in our economic institutions, the jobs and the work that we can do, the form of life that we can share. People are right to feel, and Andrew acknowledges this eloquently in one paragraph of his essay, but I don't think that he gives it the significance that that I would give it. People recognize that this has been broken and taken away from them. I take his essay to argue that on this occasion, the people are steamed up and democracy overheats, as it has a tendency to do. I take the lesson to be that it must be an occasion for democratic self-assertion, and we need to try to find some part of ourselves that can hear the people who are drawn to Trump in that register, even as we fight him.
Are you hearing Jedediah Purdy, Andrew?
Yes, I am. I should say, first of all, I was extremely grateful for his piece, which I thought was fair and interesting. And I'm not sure there's a huge amount of difference, actually. It may sound that way, but I don't think there is. I absolutely think that what is happening is a response at some level to the impact of globalization and technology and the rapid downward mobility of people who a generation or two ago, by means of simple manual labor or other less complicated skills, had much more value in the economy and therefore had much more dignity in the society. And I do think there is a broken heart in America that is that is clearly there. The question is whether, there's no question either that that's something that we all have to address more seriously. And the benefit of a democracy the way we've had it is that it's come around and told all of us, this matters. People can't handle much more of this. You've got to do something about it. And to my mind, that's the role of our democracy. And it should be a way in which the elites of this country respond to that. And we actually formulate and construct constructive policies to try and mitigate some of that. My concern is simply not just a cultural one, because I do think that Donald Trump is unimaginable without the coarseness and vulgarity of reality television, the mass democratization of media in which everybody has a voice, in which there's absolutely no gatekeeper left, in which anybody can reach mass audiences instantly in ways they couldn't have done before. I do think that all this has also hypercharged democratic feeling. And you see it also in little things like, and this is a critical thing with respect to what Gordon Wood said, the Supreme Court is currently being held open for their election. And the presidential candidate of one party is putting up lists of potential justices for Democratic approval. This is a huge hole in the protections against tyranny. He's also prepared to, and we've seen, violate the laws of war and said he wants to initiate torture and to order people to do illegal things. That's not something that a constitution can easily withhold, especially with the possibility of terror attacks in the future. He's arguing for things that no one has ever argued for before. And I think without the democratization of the media, without the vulgarity of our current discourse, without him being essentially running for president as a reality television catalyst, this wouldn't be happening. And so I think the cultural piece has to be part of the explanation and understanding, but the political piece, the actual institutional restraints upon what the majority might do, and I'm not saying we should treat them disrespectfully, I don't think I do in the piece, but that's an extraordinarily dangerous moment in this country.
Andrew, I want to push back a little bit in my own terms. I mean, I don't want to blame the people, and I don't want to dampen the democracy around the whole big picture. We've heard a lot of this before. I heard it in the 70s, post-Vietnam, from David Rockefeller and the Trilateral Commission. Cool the jets of protest, you know, all those cranky 60s voices. The old Al Smith line from the 20s had been, all the ills of democracy can be cured by more democracy. The policy class in the 70s, and I think you today, are saying, no, the cure for this, for all this agitation is a little less democracy. And there was after the 70s.
I think my concern is less we need less democracy than that we need to have a stronger pushback on the massive democracy that we have. Now, maybe that's a slightly contorted way of putting it, but I do also think that we are actually at, as I say, a historically new moment. You have to explain why no one with this kind of argument, at a time of 5% unemployment, I mean, at a time in which we've had 50, I don't know how many months of continuous growth, and in fact, relatively low unemployment, that we could nonetheless create this kind of extraordinary potential for such a demagogic and dangerous figure to emerge. This is not happening in the middle of the Great Depression. It's not happening. And the idea that
Jimmy Lee's in a Great Depression
failed, the idea that the American economy has failed when it is by far the most dynamic in the world and has responded extremely well the last 7 years, the idea this system has failed when it's been able to do that, it seems to me to be overdoing it. It seems to me we're getting out of perspective exactly what we have, how successful this model has been, how successful it can continue to be, and how it doesn't have to be turned upside down in order for us to make progress against certain problems.
Stand by, Andrew. I want Orlando Patterson to help us out. You've been studying freedom, democracy, race, slavery for a lifetime, Orlando, going back to ancient Athens. You pronounced in 2008 that the inclusive campaign that brought women, young people, white and black into the victory of Barack Obama was the high watermark of the democratic idea, maybe for all time. Can it be so close to the brink 8 years later?
Yeah. From my position as a black person from the Caribbean, an immigrant here in America, and a black American, I could never condone any view which claims that there's too much democracy. Had it not been for democracy, I'd still be cutting canes on the plantation of Jamaica. Obama would still be picking cotton, to exaggerate a little bit. So no, but at the same time, I totally agree that what we're facing now with Trump is an abomination. So the question is, why? How did we get here? And there's three sets of factors which seem to me explains this. One has to do with the economic system within which the democracy we are now talking about is embedded. You can never separate the two. And there is something profoundly wrong. This has been mentioned, but I think the point must be emphasized. There's something profoundly wrong with late post-industrial capitalism, which is simply this, that there is the economist view, which we hear a lot, which is that, you know, globalization, is inevitable, that it leads to increased returns and all the rest of it. The problem, as I think even some economists are beginning to recognize now, is that the people who create the wealth, whose extraordinary productivity generates much of this wealth, and in fact, the global capitalist system, nonetheless find that the rewards, and there are rewards which come back to America, are in fact being earned by a very small minority. And this is just profoundly unfair. It's not fair. And democracy ultimately is about fairness, as is freedom, as is justice. And so we have this profound dilemma which our economist experts and our politicians have simply blinded themselves to. And in that sense, as alarming as it may be, what Bernie and what Trump, as abominable as he may be, they've been doing is to shake up the system, at the very least to say to people, hey, you've got to recognize that there's something profoundly wrong with late post-industrial capitalism. And so that's the first thing.
Didn't you tweet this week that Trump could be a blessing in disguise in just that way?
As long as he doesn't get elected, he would be a blessing in disguise. As is Bernie, yeah. I mean, the second thing I want to say then is that I think the problem is not democracy in America, but the institutional framework within which democracy exists. And now several of these have been mentioned. The Supreme Court has been mentioned, but, you know, I'm very ambivalent about the American Supreme Court. The Constitution did not give the Supreme Court the power that it now wields. Judicial review is something that evolved, and it was a very much a right-wing sort of development. And we have seen in some cases where it's benefited, the poor and the dispossessed. But in most cases, what we've seen is working from the Dred Scott case right through until the 60s, is a very powerful conservative, anti-democratic force. And in fact, after that hiatus between the 60s and the 80s, in fact, it's gone back to that profoundly conservative role. I mean, the Supreme Court is responsible for the emerging plutocracy in this society, the fact that the rich now determine who, is nominated, who gets elected. So I'm not one who celebrates this. I think the American primary system, too, is the institutional disaster. I mean, the British system, and Andrew should, I'm sure, has to agree with me on this. I mean, we have a crazy system here where it's perpetual elections, going on 18 months before, compared with, say, the British elections, which last for 5 weeks. This system is chaotic. It's also unfair in the sense that it pushes to the beginning of the primary process the most conservative, unrepresentative states in the nation, and so on.
It's also semi-private. Various rules, open, closed.
So there are institutional problems with American democracy. And finally, we may not have time now,
Real quick.
It has to do with the problem of freedom itself. That something culturally has emerged in the political culture of America, and that is the uncoupling of freedom from democracy. If you want to talk some more about that.
Orlando Patterson, Andrew Sullivan, Jedediah Purdy, stand by. Coming up, the rage inside the Trump machine. The repentant neoconservative Francis Fukuyama, still an influential policy wonk himself, is telling us that the furious peasants have got the modern history of their distress pretty much right. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. On this matter of democracy, the meta public intellectual Francis Fukuyama won his 15 minutes of fame a quarter century ago with a book title that buried the Cold War hatchet, The End of History. Was his claim that the future belonged to liberal democracies with mixed economies on the U.S. model. Today, Fukuyama is very openly rueful about the military adventures of our short-term hyperpower. In conversation with us, he linked a chain of elite mistakes to the sour populism of 2016.
Well, you have to begin with the fact that there's a broad belief that the system, the democratic system in this country, is fundamentally broken. And I think, unfortunately, there's something to that. The country has been polarized between the two parties so that Congress has not passed a budget under its regular order for years and years now. We can't make decisions on infrastructure, on tax reform, a lot of things that really need to be done. And I think there's also a perception out there that the government's been captured by powerful, well-organized interest groups that serve their own interests, and somehow the system can't get beyond that. And I think that Donald Trump, you know, when he says the government's run by a bunch of morons and losers, it sort of reflects this view, which I think is actually correct, that the government is not functioning well. His diagnosis of why it's not working well, I think, is completely wrong, but I do think that people are responding to this underlying ineffectiveness of institutions, and they now want a strong leader that will get through all the miasma of normal Washington politics.
What about our career abroad in the last 25, 30, maybe 50 years, including Vietnam? Factor that in, if you will, to what people are upset about.
So there's been a big change in the distribution of power around the world. The world that emerged after the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 was a very unnatural world in which the United States was by far the dominant hegemonic power. And that's part of the reason we felt it was okay to invade Iraq, because there wasn't any countervailing power that would have balanced us the way the Soviet Union would have balanced us during the Cold War, and plus which we just made policy mistakes. That is really painful, you know, to admit, but I think the invasion of Iraq in foreign policy and then the deregulation of the financial sector that had taken place under both Democrats and Republicans that laid the ground for the financial crisis. And I think both of those diminished American power and prestige in the world. And so I think that that's very hard to adjust from a position where you're really the number one hegemonic country to one in which you actually have to share power with other countries. After these two really costly wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, people are just not that interested, including Republicans that are normally quite hawkish on these issues.
That sounds right to me, that there's a kind of embarrassment associated with the American record abroad. I wonder, do you ever suppose that Donald Trump is pointing his finger at you guys, the policy class?
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely.
Deal with that a little bit.
Well, this really, I think, is an elite, you know, base issue, because the elites in the Republican Party that do foreign policy, you know, were the people that engineered the whole Iraq invasion. And to this day, none of those principals that were involved in that have ever publicly come out and said, yeah, we made a big mistake. And I think that the base in the Republican Party recognizes that it was a mistake. And so Trump is simply, you know, saying the emperor has no clothes. And I think, you know, he's right to do that.
Is there a way that we could turn this kind of scary breakdown of the party game into a rebirth?
I do see this as a potential reform moment in American politics. But, you know, the trouble is it really does depend at that point on leadership. So if you think about what happened across the developed world in the 1930s, you had Franklin Roosevelt that used the Great Depression as a means of building something positive. And then you had Hitler and Mussolini in Europe that used exactly the same unhappiness and did something really terrible. So I think there's a both opportunity and danger in that kind of popular mobilization right now.
That was Francis Fukuyama. He runs the Stanford University Center on Democracy, Development, and the Rule of Law. He was awarded a Centennial Medal at Harvard this graduation week. Andrew Sullivan, let me ask you what I asked Frank Fukuyama. Do you ever suppose that Donald Trump and his troops are pointing their fingers at you in the policy elite and the Iraq war connection? Go ahead.
Yes. Well, I'm sure, yes. Of course. And I think Frank is totally right about those two things. And they have discredited the establishment in so many ways. And I think combined with the Wall Street collapse, you can, you know, you can understand why people feel the country has not been well governed, and it hasn't in those two respects. At the same time, I think, again, the sweeping nature and sweeping things that people have been saying is a little exaggerated. It's just not true that the entire political system is controlled by a tiny few, or that tiny few have somehow manipulated the system. The story actually is much worse than that. Is that the globalization has actually exposed and forced a huge section of the American working and middle classes to international competition, the like of which they've never had, and we didn't have at all before the end of the Cold War. It's the great paradox of winning the Cold War, is that now people are competing globally with so many more people in the global capitalist system, and that puts a terrible downward pressure. It's not that they're incredibly productive, they are, but others are more productive. And the reason the gains are going largely to the extreme top is partly a function of, I agree, a concentration of wealth that we should break up and for the good of everybody, but also, unfortunately, just because the kind of skills intellectually, scientifically, technologically that are rewarded in this culture tend to go to people, very few people that smart, that able to really cash in on these incredible new technologies and their global reach. And that's built in too. So it's a perfect storm of all these different economic factors that are putting a terrible squeeze on a lot of people in this country. But at the same time, it must be said that, you know, the quality of life and standard of living of people is clearly as high as any human being has ever really existed on in planet Earth. The United States is doing better than almost anywhere else on planet Earth, and we do need to adjust. But let us not trash the entire system that brought us this level of sophistication.
Jedediah, I want to hear you on the elite base issue and the imbalances there. And let's not forget Jimmy Lee in Indiana, too. Jedediah Pretty.
Sure. So I think one thing we have to confront, and I think much of what Andrew says is true and important. In fact, I think it's all true and important, but it's, of course, not the whole truth. First, the elite that people are outraged at, the Clinton elite of the 90s that worked to make a rapprochement with the financial industry and with much of the rest of American industry.
Meaning they brought the Wall Street into the White House.
Yeah, and into the Democratic Party, that's right. And the Bush elite of the aughts, in substantial part, built politically the world of disparate rewards that we're talking about. Some of it is technology, but some of it is the deliberate political construction of the particular kind of international trade regime. And
then we say tax policy.
Yes, and tax policy and the particular scheme of financial regulation that actually provides the opportunity for tremendous rewards to highly sophisticated systemic manipulation, much of which has a really dubious level of return to the real economy and to most people. So to a considerable extent, even what we call globalization and the new economy were politically constructed by this elite, by this transpartisan elite, which has basically identified itself with the task of ushering in this economy and trying to manage it over the last 30 years. So no wonder that people have a sense of betrayal by this elite and that they want to throw it out. So what are we going to say about this? I think it's difficult for me as a person who studies the history of the Supreme Court in particular and American politics in general to take too romantic a view of their role. They've done best when they have taken their marching orders, really, ultimately. And other American elites have done best when they've taken their marching orders from movements that have voiced radical demands for more equality, a different and fairer distribution of dignity, and more meaningful personal liberty through a democratic process that has often been messy and destructive.
Andrew, I want you to take a crack at it and leave room for Orlando Patterson, please.
Sure. I just want to say that take the Iraq War or the financial deregulation. There were elections during this period of time. The Iraq War was incredibly popular at the beginning. It had strong public support, and I think if it hadn't, it would not have been engaged in. And the person who committed that vast error was reelected not soon afterwards. So, again, the idea that the elites did all of this and democracy does not have any role to play, you only give democracy its props when it does something good, but don't. I mean, let me give you one simple example. We live with a massive debt. Why do we live with a massive debt? Because since Ronald Reagan, who bears a huge amount of responsibility for it, promised a popular tax cut that everybody liked in democracy, the democracy also didn't want any entitlement cuts, and the democracy liked the wars. And so, in other words, if you look at the really big picture, you see that it's the majority of people in this country who have brought a lot of this problems upon themselves through the democratic system. The elites have systematically...
I think we're blaming the people again, Andrew.
It's been a pretty awful period of time.
And, Orlando Patterson.
Yeah. You're right.
Who's right?
You're blaming the people again. This is, as I see it, primarily an institutional failure. As I mentioned earlier, I mean, we got to be careful not to fall into the flat earth sort of lauding of globalization. There are other countries which have confronted globalization successfully, but have not ended up with its working class and its middle class gutted. Let's take West Germany. Take even Andrew's country, Britain, with all its flaws, nonetheless, has the institutional framework where the what we earn from globalization does not go to a concentrated small minority. This is the fundamental problem, and this is an institutional one. There are not sufficient institutional structures in place which will divvy up the returns from globalization to a larger number of people. The working classes are just catching hell. And it seems to me that one has to be careful to talk about American economy doing very well. It's doing very well, but for the benefit of a small minority. That is a fundamental problem. And this is an institutional failure, because Germany, Britain, Sweden, Denmark all show that it's possible to have institutional structures which prevent this unfair distribution of the rewards of globalization. And that's the fundamental problem as I see it. And the workers are absolutely right to be enraged. And when workers get enraged in a democracy, this is what they do. They elect Hitlers, they elect Trumps, and so on. What I see the fundamental problem as the unfair returns of globalization. This is not a criticism of globalization. This is a criticism of the absence of the institutional structures which other countries have shown are possible to allow for a fairer distribution of the returns of this wonderful global system we have.
One more crack, Andrew.
Well, I agree in some respects that, yes, other people have done a little bit better, but not much. Britain has the same kind of unequal situation that the United States has, and Germany increasingly as well. These are very powerful global forces driven in part by technology. I mean, if you think the workers are mad now, imagine what's going to happen when they're all replaced by robots, which is not far off. I agree we have to do something to understand the impact of globalization. But I don't agree that it's some entirely rigged system. The thing is that the problems are actually deeper than that. They're embedded in the evolution of this economy and its globalization. That's where it's embedded. We have to address it politically. But we can't just keep blaming elites or blaming billionaires for everything that is happening in this country.
Here's a very clever fellow, Nicholas Nassim Taleb, Mr. Black Swan. He wrote on his Facebook page this week, "The establishment, composed of journos, talking heads, bureaucrats and their cronies, lobbyists in training, New Yorker reading, semi-intellectuals, image-conscious, empty suits, Washington rent-seekers, and other well-thinking members of the vocal elites are not getting the point about what's happening and the sterility of their arguments. The point," he said, "is that people are not voting for Trump or Sanders. People are just voting, finally, to destroy the establishment." Is that a big enough institutional target for us, Orlando? Or Andrew?
Absolutely.
Jedediah?
False in this respect. The Trump movement is incapable, as it's now formulated, of giving a genuinely new set of marching orders to institutions and lawmakers and law interpreters, the people that Andrew calls our elites. I continue to believe that the movement that is coalescing around Bernie Sanders, for all its complexity and all the inevitable confusions and resentments and passions of mass mobilization, is one that is trying to give, in the manner of, let us say, the New Deal, a new set of marching orders. And we need a new set of marching orders. We don't simply need retrenchment on the institutions we've built.
Andrew, the headline, the big headline on your New York Magazine piece was Ripe for Tyranny. Walking down the street, reading the newspaper, even watching television, which I don't do, does this country feel ripe for tyranny to any of us, including you, Andrew? You started it.
I'm looking at the reality in front of us. It seems to me that a country that can give a figure of this neo-fascist policy planks and this demagoguery and vulgarity and really monstrousness, the fact that this person is a candidate for one of the major parties of the most powerful country on earth should terrify us. And the complacency that lies behind is, I guess I am a conservative. I worry about the fragility of the system. And I worry about railing about elites with no idea of what would replace them. And I see the way Burke looked at the French Revolution. I don't think this kind of energy should be unleashed. And I think we in this constitution and this culture and this economy have very little restraints left against that possibility. With luck, it'll pass. But yeah, look, yeah. If he wins, he's going to get the House. He may well get the Senate. And they've already held up the Supreme Court so he can get his pick on it.
I feel lots of restraints all around us, Andrew, even in this conversation. Thank you, Andrew Sullivan, Jedediah Purdy, Orlando Patterson. Thanks also to Francis Fukuyama and to Gordon Wood. Thanks also to Scott Carrier, who recorded that interview from the top of the show. Thanks for his terrific podcast called Home of the Brave. Independent podcasts like ours rely entirely on listeners like you for support. Please visit patreon.com/radioopensource. You can make an easy monthly donation right there via Patreon. This week's show was produced by Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Abby Duker, and Phil Guerra. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Leighton. Join us next time on Open Source.